Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producers are Jamie Lasante and Lou Pellegrino. And this week, we return to the Sports Illustrated Media Roundtable with some old friends on this podcast. John Orand is the sports media writer for the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal. And Andrew Buchholz is one of the media writers for Awful Announcing. Both John and Andrew had interesting stories this week on two different topics. We will hit both of those. And those are sort of the ESPN FS1 public relations wars. Andrew had a long column and reported column about Jim Brady, the ESPN public editor's commentary on Jemele Hill and where that led. And we will also talk about ESPN and Jemele Hill, the discipline or non-discipline, depending on where you stand, the fact that the White House got involved. We'll just touch on this a little bit as well. John and Andrew, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
What happened? Did Chad big time us?
Chad Finn was scheduled for this podcast with John Orand, but he got sick. And so emailed me about 30 minutes before the start of this to let me know that he was very apologetic, but had to pass. Totally understandable. We love Chad. But I talked to Andrew yesterday, John, about saying, Andrew, you know, if you can, if you could, you know, I thought you were going to flake, John. So I was backing you up with Andrew Buchholz. And now, as it turns out, Andrew Buchholz is taking over for Chad Finn. So you always got to have somebody in your back pocket, John, is really what it comes down to. Andrew, I appreciate. And Andrew, you are getting up at 7:30 a.m. because you're in California, and we're taping this at 10:30 in New York. So thank you very much.
And no problem. Happy to help out.
Yeah, you're a far better employee than most of the other Awful Announcing employees, Andrew. God bless you. All right, here we go. And that's for you, Matt Yoder. Actually, Matt Yoder's a very nice guy. All right. John, here's where I want to start. And Andrew, I know you've read this piece as well, and this was really interesting to me. John, you wrote a piece for Sports Business Daily this week, or maybe it was the Journal, wherever it was, it was published. And this is about the ESPN Fox Sports 1 rivalry, John, has really now shifted into a much more aggressive and public place. Obviously, the backstory on this is ESPN has been getting pounded left and right in the media. A lot of it, by the way, self-inflicted and deserved. A lot of it, though, some opportunists throughout Fox, I think, taking advantage of a lot of people, having them on to blast away at ESPN's perceived left-leaning all over the place. So, John, you wrote this story, which says flat out that there are many at ESPN who believe that 21st Century Fox is orchestrating attacks against ESPN to bolster the fortunes of rival sports channel FS1. Can you give the listeners, this is how we'll start, just some background into what you've been evaluating in the market and why you decided to write this story?
Well, I wrote the story mainly because Sanders, Huckabee Sanders, brought this up at the White House podium. I've been covering, sports media for a couple of decades now, and I can't ever recall a time when somebody was at the bullseye of the national political scene. I mean, you've had presidents doing stuff on ESPN or on appearing at the Super Bowl, but this is like, this was a really big story. And so I just thought that I'd call a bunch of people at ESPN who I know pretty well. None of them were sort of reporters on air or journalists there. Everybody was sort of in the business. I mean, we're Sports Business Journal, so it was some of the business executives, just to get a tenor of what life is like in Bristol, under that sort of gun. And so it's funny because, a big part of the people in Bristol do believe that, Fox Sports, Jason Whitlock of Fox Sports never misses an occasion, it seems, to go and attack ESPN or say something about ESPN. You have Clay Travis, who is with Fox Sports Radio. He has a show on Fox Sports Radio. He also never misses a chance to go out there. And they are starting to see a pattern there. And they think it's something that's a little bit more orchestrated. But to amplify one of your points, they feel that every single one of these stories is a self-inflicted story too. So it's not all, it's not completely, boy, Fox is really doing this to us. It's like, we're making mistakes. And every time we make a mistake, it flares up into this huge fire. I mean, ESPN, you've been covering this. They've been playing defense for how long now? It seems like they've been playing defense for a full year since Jamie Horwitz really took over, maybe a couple of years, you know? I just found that to be pretty interesting.
One more for you, John, before we get to Andrew. You know, Andrew, you're obviously going to have thoughts on this. Obviously, you're not going to give away the people that you spoke with for this, John. But what can you say? What types of people at ESPN did your reporting sort of cross in terms of? Are we talking that talent believes this? Are we talking that management believes this? Do you feel that it's really permeated throughout the ranks in a large way, or is this sort of just a couple of people at ESPN who are like, we think these guys are coordinating this, and we're tired of it, and we're going to talk to a reporter about it?
It's business executive level, so it's not talent, and it's not sort of, you know, it's not really the rank and file, and it's business executive level trying to figure out what they can do to counter what they see is, you know, Fox Sports people going on Fox News stations and not only bashing ESPN. I mean, one of the things that multiple people brought up was a Fox and Friends episode that Jason Whitlock was on, and at the end of that episode, you know, they were like, oh, so Jason, where can we see you? And they allowed him a 30-second sort of like hit to talk about Speak for Yourself. And coming out of that hit, you know, one of the hosts of the show is like, oh, we'll be watching that instead of ESPN now. You know, it almost seemed like a PSA more than a news hit.
It's interesting. Before I get to you, Andrew, I think the thing about that segment, and somebody passed that along to me, that I think would absolutely be the most frustrating for people at ESPN, is that the Fox and Friends hosts asked Jason Whitlock to get into the mind of Jemele Hill. And if I remember correctly, they said something effective, you know, you've known her for a long time. What do you think she was thinking? And then Whitlock answered. Anybody who knows Jemele Hill, anybody who's close to Jemele Hill, would counter that Jason Whitlock has no relationship right now with Jemele Hill. And so the idea that he could get into her mind about what she was thinking in all this is an absolute farce. But to John Oran's point, the whole thing did absolutely play like a promotion for a Fox Sports One show, whether intentional or not. And Fox News absolutely has the right to do that, to push their fellow shows. But it did feel, I know, Andrew, you know the wrestling the wrestling term kayfabe, and it sort of felt like a little bit of a work in terms of how can we get a little run for a Fox Sports One show that could certainly always use more ratings. And let's bring a guy on who's always happy to bash ESPN. Andrew, when you read John's story, and, you know, again, you write a lot about this, but it's always interesting to me how one reads another person's story in the space. What were some of your top line thoughts that came to mind when you read John's piece?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good piece. I actually wrote a long thing today looking at it and some of the takeaways. And to me, what really stood out, I think, is I appreciate John's level of nuance here. I think it is very true what a lot of these ESPN executives are thinking, that there is this orchestrated attack from Fox, but at the same time, it is about self-inflicted wounds. And I think the thing that's notable too is that it's not all from Fox, and it's not all coordinated specifically to promote Fox Sports One. I thought the comments that John has in there from Fox executives are interesting.
Very much.
They talk about how this is a logical thing for us to cover. Our viewers eat this up like catnip. And so I think it's sort of a little of column A, it's a little of column B. I think when you're talking about Jason Whitlock, and I wrote about this earlier this summer, but Fox is really using him as this ambassador to other Fox properties, as a guy that they can put on as, here's our FS1 guy, and here's our guy who can criticize ESPN and who can say negative things about ESPN and get attention for that, and also be sort of our ambassador to the conservative viewers. And I think we've really seen that in the last few weeks, but it's been going on all summer. It's been going on even before that, especially in the wake of the ESPN cuts. And what's maybe even more interesting to me than the Fox News hits is the constant columns for the Wall Street Journal. Because that's a place, it's also within the Murdoch empire, but it's a place where you wouldn't necessarily expect the kind of rhetoric and discussion you get on Fox News. But Jason Whitlock's bringing a lot of that same level into his columns there, and really just going after ESPN and promoting this whole narrative about ESPN's issues are about politics. And some of the criticism of ESPN is about politics, but as a lot of reporting has shown, their issues are really much bigger than that and have to do with cord cutting and subscribers, and not necessarily just this idea that it's liberal ESPN.
That's well said, Andrew. By the way, the best part of this podcast is going to be when Whitlock takes a big dump on me and avoids you two, even though you are the basically the commentators on this one, and I am the moderator. But one thing there that absolutely has to be mentioned, and John Oran did in his piece, is that a lot of this stuff by ESPN is absolutely self-inflicted. All of us have written about the overreaction of overreactions to move Robert Lee from that game. That's just a real question of just really like letting the social media marketplace dictate decisions. Forget about the fact that it was leaked, and I understand that, but like, That would have been a 1 or 2 hour story at most, and it turned into, again, a national referendum on whether ESPN is PC run amok. And too often, John, and I've written about this, I mean, ad infinitum at this point, the selective discipline of ESPN gets them in more trouble than anything else, where Colin Cowherd is not disciplined for his comments about Sean Taylor, basically inferring that Sean Taylor's lifestyle is what got him killed, when in fact it was a robbery gone wrong and had absolutely nothing to do with Sean Taylor. No discipline there. Bill Simmons criticizes Roger Goodell, gets 2 weeks of unpaid suspension. Rob Parker calls Robert Griffin III or questions Robert Griffin III's blackness. Is he a brother or a cornball brother? Parker removed from the air, but not the executives who were behind that show at that case First Take. Nothing happens to them. Doug Adler, clear overreaction in my opinion about using the term gorilla tennis, where producers at ESPN, I think, made the incorrect presumption that he was talking about Venus Williams, an African-American tennis player. So, John, on and on and on and on, we see this stuff that's self-inflicted. That said, I understand where ESPN is coming from right now in terms of publicly pushing back, because I feel like they've been taking it for 2 years from various different people at Fox, not just Whitlock and Clay Travis and now Britt McHenry, but they took it for a long time from Jamie Horowitz in terms of, pushing that ESPN's on the run from our programming, we're beating ESPN2 and slots. So, John, when you talked to the business executives at ESPN, did you also get a sense that they just maybe finally got to a point like we're tired of, yeah, I know the old adage, you're not supposed to punch down, WWF's not supposed to talk about WCW, but after a while, man, you get smacked in the head like for 2 years straight. I feel like you want to punch back at least once or twice. Did you get a sense of that?
Not necessarily. I think that from some people, certainly, there's a sense of like, okay, that's enough. And, we've been through this before. ESPN punching at Fox is not punching down. I mean, Fox has now, they have the Super Bowl, they have the World Cup, they share the Big Ten. I mean, to go and say like, well, one's on broadcast and one's on cable, like ESPN talks about what's on their college football on ABC. Right. And, I mean, they're not punching down. They're punching right at, 21st C. On that. But, the sense that I really got is, ESPN rather than sort of taking a look at what Fox is doing to talk about them or Fox News is doing to talk about them, there's a real growing sense of frustration at ESPN that they that there's not a hard and fast, you know, okay, you know, we're going to suspend Jamel for 2 weeks for that or not.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's nothing set in stone there. And there's just a sense that they're kind of flying by the seat of the pants. What they will say to you is, you know, each one is different. So what they did with Curt Schilling and that is completely different as a scenario to Jamel Hill. So to have like one rule like governing both of them, you know, doesn't work in the real world. But I think people think it does work, and they just think like, you know, they think that so a lot of the people I talk to are longtime ESPNers. They bleed ESPN, and it's getting close to like, you know, stick to sports. Do you remember like when, you know, for the longest time, when you would talk to an ESPN executive, they would always say, they would either lead off a sentence or at some point in the conversation, they would say like, look, well, we're here to serve the sports fan.
Always. Yeah, exactly.
And it was annoying as hell,
right?
You know, because it just sounded just pap. They don't say that anymore. And these long timers say, you can tell it, you know, I mean, if you're going to talk about a social issue, like if you're going to talk about, you know, Colin Kaepernick, you know, that's within the realm of sports. But if you're going to talk about Donald Trump's, you know, racial relations, that's not serving the sports fan in any way. And they just kind of want to get back to that serving the sports fan. Again, this isn't necessarily my opinion. This is born from the reporting that I did for that story.
I understand that. To me, that's a bit of a cop-out because sports are inherently political. It's a larger conversation, but whether it's gender, whether it's race, whether it's economics, those things are all part of sports. You can't escape it. It is what it is. Andrew, I do want to ask you a question because this is always something that, and all of us, I'm sure, get this on Twitter all the time. Like literally, I could say Curt Schilling should not be suspended, and people will yell. Curt Schilling should be suspended, and people will yell. So you get it either way. But one of the things I think there's not a differentiation enough in that there are ESPN commentators for sure who are left-leaning, and you know who they are on Twitter, and you see them, and whether that's Jamel Hill or Bomani Jones or Pablo Torre or Sarah Spain, you know, they I think clearly in their, at least in their social sort of, when it comes to social issues, they lean left. What happens, though, Andrew, all the time is that there's a presumption that the group of ESPN talent who is talking about this on Twitter, and by the way, it's not 500 people at ESPN doing this on Twitter. It's probably like 25. That presumption that then gets kicked to the entire network on air is this. And a lot of times I like to make the joke that, you know, when somebody says, I'm not watching The Six because it's too political, and I'll say, you're right. Last night, their discussion of Brexit and Angela Merkel was absolutely ridiculous. You know, to try to make the larger sort of point of the absurdity of the fact that if you actually watch ESPN for 24 hours a day, you don't see much politics. You see live games. You see occasionally some of their commentators maybe delve into this, but for the most part, their commentators are blathering on about something that is rooted in the sports world. Do you see that as I do in terms of that it's – I think there's been a little bit of a narrative run on you've taken a couple of people who are really active on social media tweeting about this kind of stuff. And the presumption is that they're doing this on air, where the reality is they rarely do it on air.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and that's really a key point here. I mean, the whole ESPN as an entity is liberal narrative is garbage, really. I mean, it's not the entire network. It's not the vast amount of people who work there, and it's not most of what's shown on the air. And I mean, the thing that's funny here too is that there's so much debate about a few commentators who are mostly talking about this on Twitter, but even when it does come to on the air, you're talking about a few shows with a pretty small audience compared to ESPN's global programming. I made a joke on Twitter a little while ago about somebody, it's like, oh, well, I only watch ESPN for the games. And well, most ESPN viewers only watch right. for the games. Like, the live sports are really the key, the most important part in terms of attracting the audience. And I really don't think their live sports broadcasts have ever been close to political, except for maybe Chris Berman's digressions on Roger Goodell and Ray Rice. But, I mean, it's not... The vast majority of ESPN on-air programming is not going to be that and has never been that. They'll occasionally touch on it on some of the commentary shows when there's a sports-related topic, but you're absolutely right that it's not the majority of the time. And the vast majority of ESPN talent isn't talking about politics anywhere on Twitter or whatever. So, yeah, I feel like it's this narrative that's very much overinflated and about taking a few people's actions and really just sewing a whole sweater out of them. And I think the larger problem there too, and you guys both see this in the media space, is there's, and part of why this blew up is because it was Jemele Hill. And there's so much conversation about Jemele Hill and about SC6. And you see more people weighing in with opinions about SC6, and I don't like this. I don't like ESPN doing this. But the vast majority of them have never actually watched the show, never watched the 6 p.m. Sports Center before that. So it's very interesting to me that something that really, I mean, it's an important show, certainly, but it's not the majority of ESPN's programming. It's one show per day, and yet that is becoming this giant narrative around the company. And that's why I think it's really interesting to see ESPN punching back this way. And they've been doing this for a while. I mean, Burke Magnus in particular, I know, Richard, you talked to him last September, and he was talking about them, Fox, only getting headlines when they bash ESPN. He did it again to John earlier this summer. So, I mean, that's a high-level guy. That's a guy who's very publicly been saying, Fox is out to get us. Fox is the one driving this narrative. But to me, the thing that was really interesting about John's story is showing that that's not just him, that it is sort of spread throughout these ESPN business people. And I think there's a lot of logic to it. It's not the entire thing. A lot of people bashing ESPN for liberal politics don't necessarily have a Fox connection. I mean, Clay Travis doesn't really anymore. His radio shows for Premier Networks. His site's independent. Breitbart, not really a Fox connection. But all of these sites are figuring out they can make hay by bashing ESPN. And Fox is both giving them a voice and then getting their own people to do it too, especially when it comes to Whitlock. So I think there's definitely a point there, and it's interesting to me to see how widespread that is becoming throughout ESPN, this idea that Fox is after us for this.
Yeah, a couple things I want to go there, and then I'll obviously let John respond. And listen, there's no doubt that ESPN does do political programming at times, town halls, etc. I think they certainly did more under Obama. But again, as Andrew sort of points out, if you really sort of step back and you're honest with yourself about how much of the on-air linear television coverage or ESPN3 coverage is political, I think you would find that there's not much. There's no doubt, too, that SportsCenter 6 has become essentially the centerpiece of a lot of this argument. As I said, and I think I've said with John, as I've certainly written a million times, independent of everything else, Jemele Hill and Michael Smith are not going to raise the ratings of that time slot. That time slot is essentially dead in terms of increasing. You could put John Orand, Andrew Buchholz, and Richard Deitch there, and the ratings would go down. You could put Kim Kardashian, Selena Gomez, and Kanye West, and the ratings will eventually go down. Probably they'll go up initially because there'll be curiosity tune in for those three. But that's the problem. The world has changed. That show's epicenter at 6 p.m. have changed. So people who want to sort of, you know, say the ratings for Hill and Smith are down because of X, it's not true. They were going down anyway. And as a general rule, their ratings have not been that terrible compared to the previous years. They've been up in certain spots and down in certain spots. I do believe, though, John, and this is what I want to get you on because I think your insight into this would be good. A couple of months ago, I did a podcast with Jim Miller. And he stunned me by saying he did I don't want to misquote him here, but he might have said to me 1 year from when we taped that podcast, he predicted that Jemele Hill and Michael Smith would not be on the air at that slot. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize. But essentially, he said that he would not bet that they'd be around in that slot for 2 years, for a year from now. That kind of stunned me. But after this week, John, I think I'm now closer to the Miller side. What I read from Think Progress, talking to people within ESPN, and not seeing John Skipper publicly come out in his statement, even on top of everything else, don't talk politics, blah, 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 not to publicly say, hey, you know, Jemele is one of ours and she's not going anywhere. I wonder if you're Jemele Hill and Michael Smith, how you feel. Do you feel that you've been, do you feel that ESPN has your back, even if you were not per se suspended? Do you have any thoughts on that, John? And by the way, I believe, having talked to multiple people now, I believe the Think Progress piece to absolutely be true. And I honestly, I'll put this out there, I would not be surprised if there were some people at ESPN who wanted to suspend Jemele for the day at least and send her home to sort of let things clear over. I believe Think Progress piece, there's a lot of truth to that. But I realize I didn't really ask a great question, John, but how do you see where SE6 may be a year or 2 years from now?
I don't really have a strong opinion on that. I haven't talked to people who would know about that. I will reference, though, Bill Simmons's column where he addressed that very topic, and it made a lot of sense to me. I mean, Jemele Hill right now has such fervent support that she seems almost bulletproof to me in a certain sense.
See, I don't read that. I don't read it like that. That's interesting. I saw Simmons's comments, but I don't see it that way. You do, because you think that her visibility is just so high now after Sarah Huckabee Sanders calling her out, and this is true. She certainly, if you did try to pull her now, there's no doubt that you'd have a lot of people of color who are your viewers up in arms. There's no doubt about that.
Well, not only that. So, like, if you were to pull her now, her base of support of people that are firmly, completely love her and support her would be completely pissed off, and you wouldn't mollify the people that hate her and want her off. And so it's sort of almost like a no-win situation.
Right.
It's a lose-lose situation to a certain extent.
Yeah. First of all, she should absolutely not, in my opinion, have not have been fired. Suspended is it's a longer, larger conversation. I have, as I said with Schilling, at least the first two times, I'm a believer that your social media feed is your feed, and you hire these people, certainly in Jemele's case, to be an opinionist, and then she offers an opinion on social media, which, again, I would say she owns, even if she's a representative of ESPN, and then people are upset about what she has to say regarding her experiences as a woman of color in this country. I think where personally she got in trouble was the word white supremacist more than racist. I think there's ample proof out there. If you want to argue about Donald Trump's racism from Central Park 5, saying Mexican immigrants are bringing crime, to talking about a judge regarding the lawsuit of Trump University, saying he's unfair because he's a Mexican, accusing China and South Korea of stealing jobs, budget cuts for HIV and AIDS. I mean, Joe Arpaio, I can go on and on and on and make a pretty good case. I think people know where I stand, at least on Donald Trump. So I apologize to anybody who's pissed off at my commentary here, but you already know what you're getting from this podcast, and I try to be transparent and truthful to you guys. Andrew.
Yeah, well, Richard,
go ahead.
Can I jump in for a quick second?
Yeah.
I just want to push back on the whole idea of, you know, I don't think Tucker Carlson and Jason Whitlock invented this ESPN is liberal out of thin air.
Okay.
I think that there's a, certainly a perception out there.
Definitely.
Think Andrew is right. I mean, the vast majority of programming on ESPN deals with sports and doesn't delve into the political. When it does delve into the political, it goes left. And I think that, you know, that's something that is really registering out there. I have friends that are not in the industry who are conservative friends who absolutely see ESPN as being a liberal bastion, and it irritates them, and it started, as we all know, back with Caitlyn Jenner, and kind of coming right on through. And you take a look at Bob Iger is rumored to be running for president as a Democrat. We know John Skipper's politics.
Right.
All the decision makers are not just Democrats. They're pretty left-leaning Democrats. And so I personally, I never dismiss the charges that ESPN is too liberal, because I hear it from too many people who are not necessarily swayed, who don't necessarily have an axe to grind in terms of supporting Fox Sports 1 or not. And I just think that that's something that I've been saying this on your pod for a year. That's something that ESPN really needs to address at some point, I would think.
I agree 100%. And as Bob Lee said, that a lot of the issues that the company has is probably based in diversity of thought, not diversity. And I don't think you're wrong on that. I think there are many places in terms of on air where you could have traditional sports commentators who are conservative address however they want to address in a taking a quote unquote sort of conservative viewpoint. Then people are going to bring up, well, what about Schilling? Well, again, Schilling Schilling had multiple sort of chances here. Suspended in 2015, shared the Facebook post a month later, was sort of told repeatedly by ESPN not to do that. But John, I don't disagree with you. I think there are a lot of honest people sort of on the right of the aisle who do think that their voices are not being heard enough on ESPN. And there's probably some truth to that. I don't know. I don't particularly think it was a great idea, but I don't know if that's why they brought Hank Williams back. I don't know if that's why they're going to try to push Will Cain. But, I think a guy like Bob Lee, who's not certainly left-leaning.
Makes
a fair point that the network could use more diversity of thought. To at least Andrew and on my point, I'll get back to Andrew here, is I do – it is very frustrating, though, when there are just people who cherry-pick sort of what people are saying on their Twitter feeds and then make the larger presumption that the whole network is a Bernie Sanders rally. But Andrew, I'd be curious to get your take on what you just heard from John.
Yeah, no, I think John's absolutely right there. I think that when ESPN does go political, it is generally to the left. And I think looking at the executives and their politics makes some sense. I think it's just, again, it's the divide between what people are saying on Twitter and what they're actually saying on the air, though. And I think that, yeah, there's points where you can say, oh, this is absolutely ESPN taking a liberal slant. But it's not the majority of the programming. It's certainly not everybody there. And it's certainly not the company as the whole. I think the thing that's interesting, though, and we talked about stick to sports a bit earlier, and I think part of this is coming up because politics are becoming more and more mixed in with sports these days. And so you get things like one that really stood out to me this past year was a lot of the coverage about the bathroom bills and the NCAA's response to that.
Right.
And That's a story that's absolutely a sports story. I mean, it's a story where you're now moving one of the major sports tournaments because of the NCAA's stance. And so when ESPN does cover that, that's something that gets political. And I think something that's really interesting there too is the divide on what's political and what's social. Jamel Hill has talked about that, about how she sees a lot of her commentary as social commentary, not necessarily political commentary, but that line is incredibly blurry these days. And when ESPN puts out their statements about we're for inclusion, we're for a fair workplace environment, that was some of the stuff that came up with Kurt Schilling. Of a big problem was that he was making attacks against a group of people, with transgender people. And I feel that didn't start as a political stance. That starts as a workplace stance. That starts as we want to be inclusive. We want everyone to feel welcomed. But in 2017, those issues are becoming very political as well as social. And they're certainly
it's a political position to not want that inclusion, to not push for transgender rights and so on beyond that.
One thing that before we go on to, we sort of already touched on Jemele Hill a little bit. But one thing I do want to sort of say publicly, at least this is my opinion off the John Oran piece about Fox, and two things I guess I want to say on this. One, ESPN PR sort of going 1v1 against a Fox Sports Radio personality, they're going to lose that every time. Because it's you're sort of, at least in Mike Soltis's case with Clay Travis, you're kind of sort of given Travis what he wants. I'm not sure Mike Soltis should be, you know, sitting there listening to how many times the word boobs is on Fox Sports Radio. I feel like there's probably better uses of his time. But that's just going to play into what sort of Travis wants. People are always, you know, looking to bash PR departments. Anyway, Soltis probably should play a higher game there. Go after Fox Sports corporate. Stay away from the personalities. But to get to John's point, you know, I don't think, John, as I don't think you do either, there's some like directive in the sky from Rupert Murdoch or, you know, the overlords in some Fox News building in New York City that, you know, here's our plan to take down ESPN. I always think it's more of you hire people and you see these people appearing on different places to push the narrative or whatever narratives they want about ESPN, not to mention pushing their brands. And you as an executive don't do anything. You just sort of, you enable it. You let them do what you want. You say that, hey, talent, you know, we hire talent so talent can do what they want. That's kind of where I see Fox Sports' executives and their PR department's role in this. I don't think they're necessarily, there are these meetings that say, you know, what can we do today to take down ESPN? I think it's more of, hey, if our guys are going on Tucker Carlson blasting ESPN, that's a good day for us. And let's head to Malibu for some steaks.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I talked to several people that hate Fox and used to work there, and people that love Fox and used to work there and still work there. Nobody had ever heard of such a directive coming from Murdoch or 21st C. Most of them know the internal the way 21st C works and suggests like getting Fox News to play with Fox Sports is something that would be very difficult to happen. I take this as, you know, look, Jemele Hill saying that the president is a white supremacist is something that I can see Clay Travis and Jason Whitlock being an opportunist and starting to amplify that because they know that's going to drive traffic. I mean, I think it's as simple as that. And I think Eric Shanks could end it very quickly, and he's chosen not to.
All right, let's take a brief moment away from our conversation with Andrew and John to talk about HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience and not just the final plate. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks who are short on time. I have tried HelloFresh. It is fantastic. I am not the greatest cook at all, but for a schmo like me, HelloFresh just makes it absolutely easy to cook well and to cook healthy, which is something that's important for all of us. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients. It is measured to the exact quantities needed, so there's no food waste. They employ two full-time registered dietitians on staff, so those dietitians review each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. This is also very important as well. HelloFresh delivers food to your doorstep in a recyclable, insulated box for free. HelloFresh also has light summer meals. Get in while you can. And they've just introduced some breakfast options. Okay, so how do you get this? Here is how. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code Richard, R-I-C-H-A-R-D. Again, for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code Richard, R-I-C-H-A-R-D. Once again, HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. HelloFresh, once again, $30 off your first week. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code RICHARD. John, one last thing on your reporting here, which is fascinating to me. How concerned was 21st Century Fox when you're calling them about this? Because I got to believe you're the only reporter who they've heard from. That's the corporate level, not the Fox Sports PR level. And I wonder, were they, if you can give the listeners a little inside baseball, were they doing the, hey, where do you see your piece going? Hey, could you give us a heads up on when it's going to come out? Hey, you know what I mean? Like, were they trying to stage manage a little bit of what you were going to do?
No, I wouldn't say they were trying to stage manage. I think that that there was certainly some concern about whether or not that was going to be the lead, and I was going to try to paint some sort of smoking gun that I could not find and did not see about them doing that. So there was a little bit concern with that, but it was more just sort of like incredulousness about, you know, ESPN really believes that. I mean, that, you know, these are issues that, you know, that are, we've said, self-inflicted wounds a bunch of times here. It's like, nobody at 21st C caused Jamel to make that tweet to somebody with, you know, 40 followers.
Right.
You know, that's something that happened at ESPN, and you know, it ended up being talked about at the White House.
All right, Andrew, let's shift very quickly to Jamel Hill, and then we'll move to your story about the ESPN public editor and his response to the Jamel Hill calling Donald Trump a white supremacist, and Jim Brady is on the record saying he's, you know, this is the public editor, it seems clear the company leans left. The word "seems" there is interesting. It's a subjective take, but his take, all the same. Andrew, do you again, I realize this is kind of Monday morning quarterbacking, and we have to preface this. This is important here. These are three white men talking about this in terms of what to do about Jamel Hill's belief of the president of the United States, who, again, in my opinion, would have a lot to answer to on the issue of race relations. So we'll just sort of put that out there. But, Andrew, as you look back at this now a couple days later, do you feel Jamel Hill should have been suspended or face some other discipline? If so, why? If not, why?
No, I don't think Jamel Hill should have been suspended. And I mean, it's a difficult conversation because of ESPN's inconsistency with suspensions and inconsistency with discipline, as you guys pointed out. I mean, when you suspend Bill Simmons for multiple weeks for calling Roger Goodell a liar, you could apply that precedent and suspend everyone for everything. But I think in this case, I think they were right not to suspend her. I feel if you did try and suspend her, there would have been just an incredible backlash and a revolt in the ranks. And I think, as you guys mentioned, that Think Progress story about ESPN trying to pull her off the air and other people refusing to replace her because they believe in what she's doing here, I think that's very telling and very informative, and it really shows why they didn't suspend her in the end and why they were probably right not to do so. What I think they did wrong, though, is they took the approach of trying to appeal to everyone on this one, and by doing that, they satisfied no one. And you guys mentioned Hank Williams earlier, and I think that's the exact thing they did there. They brought back Hank Williams six years after he got in trouble and lost his ESPN gig for comparing President Obama to Hitler. They bring him back, and maybe as part of this, oh, hey, we're not all liberal and not all left-wing. But the thing is, that kicks off a lot of people on the left. It doesn't please anyone on the right, especially when you give him this new song in combination with a lot of auto-tune, with a Jason Derulo and Florida Georgia Line, and you wind up with a mess. You wind up with something that's really designed by committee and doesn't make anyone happy. And I think that's what also happened with ESPN's handling of the Jamel Hill thing, is that obviously, anything short of firing her, and probably even firing her, was not going to make a lot of the right-wing critics happy. It would have just been, oh, here's this proof that ESPN is liberal, and they just finally went too far. But it wouldn't really have satisfied them. It would not have ended the bash ESPN for being liberal narrative. But then the approach they did take was criticized on the left in a lot of places, I think Deadspin in particular had a really interesting criticism of it because they didn't really support her. They put out the statement of, oh, well, we've talked with Jamel about this. We think these comments were inappropriate. And there hasn't been a lot of real strong corporate backing for Jamel Hill in the wake of this. And a lot of people figured there would be after this came up with the White House, after President Trump tweets about this, after Sarah Huckabee Sanders comments on it and calls it a fireable offense. A lot of people were hoping or expecting that ESPN would publicly have their employees back there. And in a lot of ways, they don't really seem to have done that.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting in that I feel a lot of what they're trying to do here is take the middle of the road and just hope that this is going to go away. But they're alienating a lot of people on the left as well as the people on the right.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is historically a trend for ESPN, is in their attempt to appease everyone, they appease no one. A couple of things there. I thought their second apology was absolute corporate horseshit. There was nobody out there, I think, on either side who somehow thought that Jamel Hill was speaking for the company. So to put out a statement saying that Jamel apologizes and realizes that she wasn't speaking for ESPN, like, who on earth even thought that? No one thought that, maybe except for ESPN's executives. That to me is just a corporate way down the middle to try to sort of point the storm at a different direction. This is where, John, I disagree with Simmons. I don't particularly think they had her back in an attempt to try to appease everybody. They never made a clear, definitive statement about her. Maybe privately they do have her back, and obviously they're paying her a ton of money. So in that sense, I guess you always have somebody's back. But there was never anything public from John Skipper or senior management that said anything specific to her, especially in the statement that he put out. You know, John, one of the things that you will hear, of course, from others is, well, Linda Cohn was suspended. So a couple things there. That's something obviously Clay Travis reported. He's been proven to certainly have sources at ESPN. You know, the Robert Lee story there was more to it than what he initially reported, but there's no doubt he got sourced from someone at ESPN because not many people could have known that decision outside of just some ESPN producers in Charlotte, maybe some ESPN college football talent. But that's, John, what the sort of the other side will say is, well, what about Linda Cohn? Now, we can get into, because we all cover this on the nuance, well, ESPN has historically always sort of thought differently when their people are criticizing the company. And that's what Linda Cohn did. But on top of that, John, and this is where, and eventually I'll get to Andrew's Jim Brady piece, this is where the public editor is just so frustrating. Like, we need to hear from Linda Cohn. Someone needs to either get Linda Cohn to say, and reporters have asked, and she's no commented, but that's where the public editor in theory's job is. He should have everybody at the company, they are basically, their charter is to talk to the public editor. You can't decline. And we need to hear from Linda Cohn, I think, in terms of what exactly happened, if anything happened, and was this a suspension, or was this a conversation, or was this something, or was this nothing? But that's what sort of those who are opposing Jamel Hill would say is, well, why was Linda Cohn suspended? Or why was Kurt Schilling fired? And John, I imagine on in your Twitter feed and elsewhere, you've seen that, right? That's usually what happens, is that somebody will mention Jamel Hill, and then there's a direct line to, well, what about Linda Cohn?
Sure, and that's the biggest problem that ESPN has right now, is that there's no everything's unequal. You know, there's no set plan for how they do things. And a lot of the decision makers that I talked to, you know, they wanted to see Jamel suspended, and they wanted to see Jamel suspended more as a statement to the rest of the company. You know, forget about the White House. They wanted to send a statement to the rest of the company of, like, you know, you can talk about sports social issues, but, you know, let's remember why you're working for ESPN and you know, kind of stick with that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can understand. I mean, I could buy that if everything was consistent. The problem is it's never consistent at that place, which remains just, again, as I've said ad infinitum, they end up basically chasing their own tail and biting their own ass far too often because of this inconsistency. By the way, John, I'm not so sure that a one-day or two-day suspension for Jamel Hill would ultimately placate anybody. I think you'd end up sort of going down the path. And then again, the larger discussion is if you're paying people to be opinionists and they're offering opinions on their private, or not private, but on their personal feeds,
what the executives would say about that is the way that President Trump tweeted about it,
right.
The way that Huckabee Sanders spoke about it. Sure, it was her private feed, but it brought ESPN into it. So did anybody really think she was speaking for ESPN? Well, yeah, a lot of people associate her with being a high-profile talent
right.
with ESPN. So,
right.
I mean, when I tweet, I certainly am representing SBJ out there. I handle my Twitter feed a lot differently than you do. But I think that seems like
a shot at me, John.
That wasn't a shot. I love your Twitter feed. Faithful follower.
But that's what
a lot of the executives that I spoke with, that's where their frustration sort of came.
I get it. And listen, I understand. If you put ESPN, I guess, anywhere in your tag, and I have SI in my tag, and Andrew has awful announcing in his tag, and these are larger questions because it does get to the heart of sort of who owns your social media feed. And the larger thing is, like, you do. But, yes, your company ultimately has the right, I guess, legally to, especially if you have a contract which says you're supposed to, quote-unquote, represent the company in a certain way. That's all subjective. They could do something, but there are multiple discussion points here because, again, if you are hiring people to be opinionists and then they offer opinion in any form or fashion, you know, to let the – this would be my take – sort of to let the White House dictate what you should be doing with your content and editorial, I feel is a very scary – place to go down the road. That leads us, Andrew. It really doesn't lead us, but I'm just going to create my own segue. By the way, God bless Britt McHenry for that Barack Obama NCAA tweet. Just fantastic. Boy, I can't get enough of rebranding. All right. Andrew, let's go to your piece on Jim Brady. By the way, I think we should congratulate the public editor for working in real time, Andrew. First, don't you think so? That's always something me and you have complained about over the years. And the public editor was working in real time for 5 hours straight.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah, and I mean, one of the big criticisms with ESPN Ombudsman before this and now the public editor, which has essentially replaced that, is that they weren't responsive, that these columns were coming out months after the fact, or in some cases never, as with the infamous pointer column on Craig James. Right. So I think
wait, is it in? Is that column in yet, Andrew? Hold on. Is it in? It's not in yet. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I think Jim Brady does deserve a lot of praise for addressing the Jemele Hill thing while it's still fresh. And but the thing I'm not so sure about, and I think this is very much ESPN told him when he took this job, and I interviewed him way back then in November 2015, ESPN told him that his job wasn't just to write columns, but also to represent, to answer questions on Twitter. They also talk about podcasts. I don't know if they're ever going to do that, but they very much made it clear. We want somebody out there engaging the public. And that's what he definitely did, responding to people for 6 hours about this. But I feel like this column in particular was one that probably would have been better just left as a column. Like, here's my piece. Agree with it. Disagree with it. Whatever. Because his tweets on this, I think, really made it much more of a story than if he'd just written the column. I mean, from our perspective at Awful Announcing, we saw his column and we're like, oh, a whatever, right? I mean, it didn't really. I don't think it really offered a ton of further insight. And it's interesting what you said earlier about the public editor's role in a lot of ways really should be the reporting, because they have that access, right? They're able to get the decision makers and able to get the people involved and to provide their comments and their perspective. But Brady's actual piece was mostly just his opinion, his version of what journalism standards are. And some agree with that, some disagree with that. But the column itself, I think it was sort of notable, but it wasn't necessarily a huge story. But when he's spending 6 hours arguing with people on Twitter about it, and in a lot of ways, like, and I mean, I understand where he's coming from. I get why he wants to defend his work. But I think that the tone there felt sort of off and felt very much of, well, I'm right and you're wrong. And I mean, in fairness, he was dealing with a lot of vitriol and a lot of sometimes personal criticism about this. But I'm not sure that his 6 hours on Twitter arguing about this really helped anyone. I think in some ways it was a negative for ESPN and only drove this story further and kept it going.
Yeah, a couple things there, and I want to get to John. And yeah, listen, the guy was facing it from all forces. I mean, Deadspinners were out there cranking on him, no doubt. What's frustrating to me, what has been frustrating to me about what was frustrating to me about this particular column, I shouldn't make a larger thing. Let's stick it to just sort of this, is what you hit on, Andrew, is that the public editor position or the ombudsman position at ESPN, like I always wanted to be the one place where you can try to come closest to a journalist working on your behalf who has access to everyone at ESPN. Earlier in Jim Brady's tenure, I wrote about this and criticized him. John Skipper declined Jim Brady, which is an absolute joke. You can't have a public editor position and then the president of the company decline the public editor. You might as well just stop the public editor position there. So that's what was so frustrating about this one, Andrew, was that I felt like had Jim Brady reported this out, and Jim Brady's had a great journalism career. He's started, you know, these news sites and is employing journalists, and I respect that. But like that was the job on this one. It was to call Jemele Hill, John Skipper, Rob King, Michael Smith, everyone and anyone who would have had a part of this and this decision to get Linda Cohn to get some kind of insight into what all this means for viewers and listeners and readers. And in the end, we got Brady's take. And again, that's Brady's take. It's fine. If he believes ESPN leans left, okay, that's his take. ESPN's got to diversify politically, fine. His take. Media objectivity is a dying ideal, fine. His take. But that, to me, is not the job here. The job is, or it should be, is to get inside that organization and put people on the record one way or another. And I think on that charter, he failed on this spectacularly. I have said for a long time that the public editor position, I don't know if you guys are going to agree with me, it seems to always go two ways. One, you get someone like Leanne Schreiber and Lipsyte, who really are sort of journalists at the core and working on behalf of the readers. They don't give a shit about whether they're going to get invited to, you know, the ESPYs or become buddies with the ESPNers. They're doing a job on there as outsiders. Then you get the reverse, where it feels like the public editor becomes a PR engine of ESPN, where I felt Poynter absolutely did that, and Don Olmeyer did that. George Solomon, I give a total pass to. He was the first one. He was just trying to create. He actually did a pretty good job for someone who was just starting. So, John, I move to you. That's how I now see the public editor, is they either become a part of the public relations apparatus or they're true outsiders. And this piece, once again, just reinforced to me that, like, it just doesn't feel like – I give ESPN a lot of credit for having the position, but I oftentimes wonder if they only have the position so they can say that they have the position. Because I wanted to hear from all the principals in that Brady column, and the only person I heard from was Brady. Your thoughts?
Yeah, here comes a big prediction for me. I predict this will be the final public editor. I think that one of the problems that you talked about is a public editor needs access. I mean, that's the whole point of having a public editor. And if you're a senior executive at ESPN, and you're going on the record, you know, even to your internal public editor, like, that moves stock price. That affects a lot. This isn't like a newspaper that's not public. So there are reasons why John Skipper is not going on the record with anybody, with anything. And for him to go on the record, on something that's not a press release is financial suicide potentially. That is never going to change at ESPN, especially now that ESPN is dragging the Disney stock rather than driving the Disney stock. And so I think because that's not going to change, I think that, the public editor position is going to be de-emphasized moving forward.
And John, I'm glad I have you on because you're aces when it comes to the business end. And I think that's accurate. I'm not management. So this stuff pisses me off, but I get it. If I was John Skipper, I understand why you wouldn't want to talk to the public editor, but then don't have the position. Then just kill it, and let's just not pretend anymore, and let's just make it honest in that this was window dressing, and you just don't have that position anymore. Andrew, again, you
by
wrote...
By the way, can I push back on one other thing?
Sure, Olmeyer, go ahead.
Olmeyer, I think they hated Olmeyer. Olmeyer was...
Because he got all the cash from them way back when, right? That's why they hated him.
But as ombudsman, he was harsh. He had some...
He was harsh on one...
I thought he had a couple of like particularly harsh columns on ESPN.
The decision was harsh, but I think otherwise I found him to be in the PR camp. But this is, you know, it's all subjective. We can... You know, again, John, you calling Olmeyer, you giving Olmeyer props will probably get you a scoop down the road. So congratulations for saying that. But it will not get you the Tiki Barber and Rondé Barber calling games for Fox. That, of course, went to Mike McCarthy. I'm sure Ryan Glassbeagle is not happy with that. We'll see who gets the next Fox scoop there. All right, Andrew, back to your column on Jim Brady. What do you think? I mean, I find you always to be a keen media observer. Do you feel that column sort of represented or represents the end of whatever this public editor ombudsman experiment was?
Yeah, I agree with John there. I think that Jim Brady is going to be the final public editor / ombudsman, and I think that column really does illustrate somewhat why. I think that he didn't necessarily do what we wanted in terms of getting that access to ESPN personalities and so on. But it's the bigger issue is that I don't think it's producing positive results for them. That column in particular certainly didn't mollify any critics. It only made people mad, and his further doubling down on Twitter made people madder and brought a lot of negative publicity to ESPN. And I don't think they're going to think that's worth it when it comes to evaluating this. And they've had this off and on history with ombudsmen, with public editors. There have been big gaps in it. At times, they've decided it isn't really worth it at all for them. I think they're going to wind up deciding that way again. Something that's interesting to note here, too, is that the sort of what they're talking about has changed a little. I mean, some of the really good and really important ombudsman columns were about actual journalistic issues. They were about ESPN sourcing controversies.
Right.
If we ever had gotten a real column on Craig James, that would have been an actual journalistic issue. And I think it's those cases where this role can be very valuable because we need to know what are ESPN's journalistic standards? What does this organization practice on those sorts of things? This, I feel, it's not so much really a journalism controversy. And I mean, it's certainly not a controversy that everyone in journalism agrees on, unlike some of the sourcing stuff. And so what it becomes here is it becomes one journalist's opinion, which is not shared by a lot of other journalists. And that just creates a feedback loop of backlash and doesn't really help the company.
And I recommend Andrew's piece on this. And Andrew, I'm not trying to kiss your ass here. This doesn't always happen, but you called up Brady, one of Brady's sports editors, Dan Levy and Dave Lozo, and got everybody's sort of side and how they saw that. And you did it in quick fashion. So I really appreciate that. When Awful Announcing sort of goes out and makes those calls, I think you guys really can lend something into the sort of conversation of ideas. So just as a reader, I really appreciated you making those calls because I learned something after reading those quotes, and at least I learned sort of where people's POV was from. And then it sort of just angered me again because it reinforced why I want the Brady to call the people at ESPN. So I appreciate that. My last point or last sort of item before I let you guys go, and I appreciate your time, John, and that's just sort of heading forward in the near term for ESPN. And this thing struck me, John, from your piece on the sort of FS1 and ESPN that was really interesting and it really stood out because it's so true. And there was an ESPNer who's talking to you, anonymously in this case, and they were bemoaning the fact that social media was more focused on Sergio Dipp and other stuff than the historic debate of Beth Mowins, who became the first woman to call a Monday Night Football game that night. And the interesting thing there, and obviously I've done a lot of stuff on Mowins, was that her work, John, by and large was praised. The story was not, oh, it's a woman on the air, oh, I hate her voice. Again, some of that was out there. But as a general rule, the story kind of was like that. It was a non-story, and that she did a great job, and that she's a good play-by-play person, and that she's legitimately an NFL play-by-play broadcaster, as CBS will put her on later on. No one's saying she's Al Michaels, but she's legit. And that's a great story for ESPN to have. And that story was nowhere for them on that Monday. And it's interesting to me, John, that like they can't seem to figure out ways to get those good stories into the popular marketplace. And I don't know if that's because social media is just too much of a den of negativity, or they're not hitting the right places, or whatever. But that struck me, John, that was so interesting, that ESPN does have some really good stories out there, but they can't seem to break through from this larger cloud that's always over their head. Which is actually, and at times, being pushed by competitors. But that was an interesting note to me, John, and I wonder just how you saw that.
Yeah, one thing that struck me about that, Richard, is that I went into this wanting to talk about Jemele Hill and Robert E. Lee, and people kept bringing up Sergio Dipp. And it was just sort of like, you know, if you're going to have what people said is like, if you're going to have the first woman calling a Monday Night Football game, you want to surround her with pros to make sure that that goes seamlessly and you have a good story coming out of it. And, you know, they saddled her with Rex Ryan, who was calling his first game, and as opposed to Beth got panned, you know, at least on my feed.
Yep.
And then you had sort of this Sergio Dipp in the first quarter, who, you know, I'm still seeing tweets about Sergio Dipp. I mean, so it just really, they didn't surround her. They didn't surround her with people that made her better, you know, and she's trying to make these other people better. And it's just a growing cause of frustration that nothing ESPN does, that they can't seem to get out of their way in terms of anything right now. And that's where the frustration comes in.
Andrew, what about you on this? And that, again, they're, you know, and if you're an ESPN PR person, you may be like, hey, we have all these great stories. You guys aren't writing about this. You're writing about our, public relations wars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, I do think John and obviously the ESPNer hit on this. It's that they can't seem to get the narrative back into positive stories. And in that case, John's not wrong. I mean, Rex Ryan did not have a good game. Sergio Dipp, They, in my opinion, totally screwed up on by not bringing the guy back to have fun with his social media moment, and also to give the guy a chance to reclaim the narrative by having a couple of reports. But how do you see it, Andrew, from your perch? It's they even the stories that they have that are really positive, they haven't been able to figure out of late to sort of push out there so that people see them for things other than the negative stuff.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think the self-inflicted wounds quote in John's piece really speaks to that. And I think it is a case of them not being able to get out of their own way. The problem isn't, and the Monday Night Football thing's a good example of that, because as you said, they didn't surround Beth with people who made her better. Instead, she was really carrying that broadcast. And so, of course, the headlines and the stories were about Sergio Dipp, because that was the bigger news. That was what people were talking about. And it's similar with a lot of these other issues. Obviously, the Jemele Hill thing, that's news, regardless of any sort of Fox agenda or not. People are going to be talking about that. The Jim Brady thing, when your public editor's going on this Twitter response for 6 hours, I mean, a lot of people are talking about that. And then that's run into a whole new week thanks to the decision to get rid of somebody from his other company who happened to criticize his role as the ESPN public editor. And so, I mean, I feel like, yes, ESPN has these good stories, and maybe the issue is that their good stories aren't newsworthy enough, or they're not buzzy enough. But I think the bigger issue is that they keep putting themselves in positions where these negative stories happened and where people are talking about that, and that's what's going to be covered, because that's what really, I mean, that's much more. It's what people are paying attention to, and ESPN has to figure out a way to not have those self-inflicted wounds and not give critics the opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, negativity sells. We all know that. We all see, a story that we've owned done on our own, Parsley or Chartbeat, but there is something there. I mean, ESPN had a fantastically conceived idea on Sunday where they had four producers sort of work hand in hand to find these Patriot fans who had left the Super Bowl early. They were at the game and they left, so they didn't see the historic comeback in person. And they interviewed them all, and they sort of it was fun. It was a fun story because, like, if you're a sports fan, you could sort of totally like understand the pain of like leaving early, thinking your team's done, and then they come back and have this incredible comeback. And like, that's the kind of stuff they gotta figure out a way to like remind the public that they do have behind the scenes a particular superb talent who really does like some of the best feature stories that exist. But right now, that is not front and center on A1 for ESPN. All right, listen, Andrew Buchholz, you filled in for Chad Finn. It was like game three of the World Series, and Chad Finn is David Price. You kicked him out. You came in like Kershaw, and you delivered. It's a great job by you, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew, you didn't seem to be too impressed by my praise for you there. I'll try to do better. John, I don't feel like I have to really go over the top and praise for you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's enough. It all sounds fake anyway.
It's fake news. You're an old head. No, in all seriousness, I appreciate both. And obviously, read Andrew at Outfall Announcing. Follow him on Twitter, John Oran. Read his stuff on Twitter and follow him at Sports Business Daily. I really do appreciate you guys doing this. I wanted to hit on all these topics, and I'm glad we could do this. Andrew, is there anything you want to promote before we get out of here? Does it Awful Announcing, aren't you guys coming back with a podcast soon? Did I read this?
We are, yeah. We've got an Awful Announcing podcast that should be dropping this week, I believe. And I appreciate your shout out on Twitter for my Brady piece, Richard. And I think the comments he gave me about why he fired Dave Loza, I think are very interesting, and they can give some insight into how he approaches the ESPN public editor position, even though it's not really about that. So I think that's a worthwhile thing to read.
Absolutely. And John Oran, I think if you're listening to this, you probably have read it or will read it, but read his piece from the Sports Business. John, is it Sports Business Daily or Sports Business Journal, the piece we talked about for on this podcast?
It was in Monday Sports Business Journal.
Okay, but you opened it to the public, right? So it's available online and Twitter, et cetera. Am I correct about that?
Absolutely. Go to like my Twitter feed, and I've tweeted out a couple of times.
Okay. Your Twitter feed is what, John?
Orand, Orand _SBJ.
Okay. So check that out, because that it's, if you really want some insight into sort of how the executives at ESPN and FS1 are thinking, I thought that was pretty good. And trust me on this, the story's only going to get bigger. These are very competitive organizations. There are a lot of people on both sides, particularly the ESPN side, who are really pissed off. And so, this is only going to grow. I feel like the Death Star finally, after a long period of time, I think is starting to fire more now on. And maybe it's two Death Stars firing each other, actually, now that I think about it. All right. My thanks to Andrew Buchholz and John Oran for their time and great insight. My thanks to Jamie Lasante and Lou Pellegrino for producing this podcast. Thanks to KTUS13 and Sports Illustrated for their support. Please check out the previous podcasts that we've done. We're close to the 140s now in terms of episodes. And last week I thought was really, really good. Evan Osnos of The New Yorker on what it's like to report in North Korea, and Marley Rivera and my colleague Luis on Sergio Dipp, Jamel Hill, and what it's like to be a Latino sports journalist and how they saw Sergio Dipp in particular through their prism. All right, thanks again for listening. Please check these podcasts out on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. For everybody I cited, particularly Jamie and Lou, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.